You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this is episode 485 of the Columbia Calling podcast. What did you think of last week's episode? That was with Maria F. Fitzgerald, interviewed, of course, by Emily Hart, about her new book. That's Los Nombres que Olvidamos. It's an impacting collection of chronicles, or, I would say experiential journalism articles here in Colombia about the conflict and her experiences in different regions. I had the good opportunity, the good luck to be able to see Maria Fitzgerald talk in person at the Gimnasio Moderno last week about the book and so on. In fact, she even signed my copy. But at the same time, it's a special book. It's an important book. Please do read it if you can. At the moment, I'm on the chapter about the Paro Nacional, and it's taking me right back to 2021 when we were watching the Estallido Social, as they were saying, all around the city and around the country, indeed. So that is an important one to cover, an important one that you should be hopefully listening to and enjoying. This week is no less important, but at the same time, it's very different. And it's something that we've been doing or looking at for quite some time. And it's thanks to the journalist Natalia Malaver, who has been in contact with us here at the Columbia Calling podcast, wishing to help out and so on and so forth. So I've invited her on, since this was something that she looked up, and it's about the Mennonite colony in Meta. How much do you know about the Mennonites in Colombia and the effects of their, well, I would say expansion, or I don't know, colony, community, or so on? It's really an unknown story. And we are joined, we are very lucky, for a brief amount of time. So it's about 15 minutes that he can be with us. It was Oscar Parra, who is the journalist for Rutas del Conflicto. That's rutasdelconflicto.com, which is an amazing media site designed to tell stories and report stories about the Colombian conflict that are not reported in the mainstream media. So I can really, really impress upon you how great that page is if you want to get beyond just the, let's say, the more tabloid headlines regarding the Colombian conflict. So Natalia was able to get in touch with Oscar, and we were able to put it together, recorded last week, and it's here now for you. A really great episode. And of course, we must celebrate young journalists wishing to come through, wishing to make their name and so on. So Natalia is on the podcast as well. And give her some feedback. Check out her Instagram page. That's Greenly Bachue. I will post that on Facebook and so on. So you can follow it, because she is an environmental journalist. And that's what she seeks to pursue in her journalism career. Anyway, please support us on patreon.com/Columbia Calling. We're into September now. I'm expecting our listener rates to increase as you're all back at work or school or university. And of course, we go over now to Emily Hart with the Columbia News Brief. Thank you again. Don't go away. The Columbia Calling podcast is sponsored by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. We are also sponsored by BNB Colombia Tours, which is a leading tour operator providing a wonderful range of exclusive small group shared tours for those over 50, along with customizable private tours to both popular and off-the-map destinations throughout this beautiful and diverse country. If you're interested in experiencing one of their unforgettable journeys through Colombia, be it a shared tour with like-minded travelers or creating a unique private package of your own, just complete the form on the Colombia Calling website, that's www.colombiacalling.co, or the BNB Colombia Tours website, that's www.bnbcolombia.com, and they'll be in touch within 24 hours to answer all of your questions and to start the planning of your exclusive Colombian adventure. So that's bnbcolombia.com and latinnews.com. Thank you for supporting our sponsors.
I'm Emily Hart, and these are your headlines for the week of September 4th, 2023. The president's son, Nicolas Petro, has lost his second lawyer in the case against him for illicit enrichment and money laundering, a case which has called into question the legitimacy of President Gustavo Petro's own campaign funding. Defence lawyer David Telecki has resigned just 1 month after the former lawyer Juan Trujillo did. He said the reasons for his resignation are of a personal nature. Trujillo, meanwhile, had resigned due to a difference of criteria, announced the day after Nicolas Petro declared his intention to collaborate with the prosecutor's office, a strategy on which the lawyer had reportedly disagreed. Talks with FARC dissident group the EMC, or Estado Mayor Central, have progressed with the launching of a dialogue mechanism, along with the creation of protocols for protection of the civilian population and a temporary national bilateral ceasefire. All this in advance of a new round of talks opening on the 17th of September. This is the end of an exploratory phase between the government and this armed group, which has been in process since the beginning of the government, under the supervision of various international representatives. Initially, the EMC and the government had announced this dialogue table for May, but following the killing of four children in Putumayo, a resultant crisis prevented further progress. This process is one of seven currently underway under the policy of total peace. The other major process with the ELN guerrilla group, the Ejército de Liberación Nacional, has just reached the end of the first month of its agreed ceasefire. Preliminary reports from civil society suggest that there were between 6 and 16 breaches attributable to the ELN and at least 2 to the security forces. Incidents during the first month of the ceasefire include confinement, displacement, and kidnapping in areas including Chocó, Nariño, Antioquia, and Arauca, among others. Though the ceasefire has seen a notable decrease in confrontations, clashes with other armed groups have continued. Many are calling for ceasefires to be negotiated not just between armed groups and the government, but between the armed groups themselves. In historical justice news, retired General Mario Montoya, commander of the army under President Álvaro Uribe, has been charged by the Special Peace Tribunal, the JEP, with extrajudicial execution, killing civilians and falsely presenting them as combat casualties, a scandal known in Colombia as false positives and part of Macro Case 3 under investigation by the court. Montoya had denied responsibility, but the court has concluded that between 2002 and 2003, there were 130 victims of execution under the unit commanded by Montoya. According to the court, Montoya himself instigated the commission of these murders. Those involved in the killings have often insisted that they were isolated events. The court has sought to show that they were in fact systematic and being carried out under orders and with incentives. In this case, magistrates have concluded that Montoya lied and covered up murders, pressured those under his command to produce casualties at all costs, and used violent language that celebrated bloodshed. Along with Montoya, and for these same crimes, 8 men from his unit are charged. All now have 30 days to acknowledge or deny their responsibility. With regional elections on their way, polling is ramping up and has revealed already various key elections dominated by single candidates without real rival. October's regional elections will elect governors and deputies at departmental level and mayors and councillors at district and municipality level. In Medellin, former presidential candidate Federico Gutierrez leads polling with nearly 65%, the next candidate having only 11. In Cali, the leading candidate Roberto Ortiz leads by nearly 30%. And in Barranquilla, Alex Char, running for his third term as mayor, has a voting intention of 86%, with the next candidate down having only 6%. This, despite new book about the Char political clan La Costa Nostra by Laura Ardila, who reveals corruption and vote-buying by the family going back years. Gutierrez, Ortiz and Char belong to the country's right-wing opposition groups. The governorships of Valle del Cauca, Cundinamarca and Santander are also seeing clear winners and little real competition in their electoral polling thus far, all according to Invamer. A public clash broke out this week between President Gustavo Petro and Argentina's leading candidate in the primaries for presidential elections. Ultra-right-wing candidate Javier Milei referred to socialists as human excrement, to which Petro responded, comparing him to Hitler. Milei then referred to Petro in response as part of the decay. Colombia's labour market has recovered 1.1 million jobs in the last year, according to the National Statistics Agency, shaking off the crisis caused by the pandemic. 674,000 jobs were reportedly recovered by women, while 453,000 went to men. Those were your headlines for this week. Thanks for listening.
And we're back. This is episode 485 of the Colombia Calling podcast. I'm Richard McColl here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this is quite a special episode, this episode 485. We have special guest Oscar Parra, who is a renowned journalist here in Colombia. But we're also bringing on someone else onto the show who I've had communication with for a couple of years now. She's starting out as a journalist, and she's the one who put us in contact. So we've got Natalia Malaver, who will be co-hosting as well today to talk about the Mennonite communities in Colombia. And not many people know much about this. So what I'm going to do now is just go over to Natalia, and she can present herself. She can introduce herself to you. She has studied journalism at the University of Sussex. That's in Brighton. She is an environmental engineer, journalist, makes documentaries. And she's the one that put us in contact. So perhaps now, Natalia, over to you.
Well, thank you, Richard. Good morning, Richard. Good morning, Oscar. Very pleased to be here, and very pleased to be in the podcast for the first time. So I'm going to be introducing Oscar. Oscar Parra is an engineer and a journalist with 15 years of experience researching and covering armed conflict in Colombia, as well as diverse political and human rights issues. He's also a journalism professor at the Universidad del Rosario, and in 2014, he created Rutas del Conflicto, which is an independent media outlet that gathers reliable information on the armed conflict in Colombia, blending traditional and digital formats, including data, investigative, and citizen journalism tools. Rutas del Conflicto was born aiming to showcase stories of the conflict that have not been documented by the traditional press or the state in official documents. One of their main stories focuses on the Mennonites' land occupation in the Colombian plains, Los Llanos Orientales, since studies made by Rutas del Conflicto and Mongabe show that in Latin America, this religious group already has 214 colonies and covered 3.9 million hectares, an area bigger than the Netherlands. In Colombia, the Mennonites colonies are located in the rural area of Puerto Gaitan, occupying at least 32,552 hectares. Therefore, we will be discussing with Oscar how these colonies arrived in the country and how they are affecting neighboring communities, the particular way in which they acquired this land, and the damaging effects they've had on the surrounding environment. Welcome, Oscar, to the podcast.
Oscar, you're up. Sound.
Can you hear me? Yes. Okay. Yeah. Thank you to both of you, to Natalia, to Richard. I'm just very happy to be here to tell you about our job.
All right. So, Oscar, I'm fascinated. I'm fascinated. I know about Mennonite communities in Bolivia. I know about Mennonite communities in Mexico and amongst other places, but we never knew anything about the Mennonites here in Colombia. So I think we start with the very basics. When did they arrive in Colombia?
We have to clarify something, that we have a big Mennonite colony in Colombia like 50 or 60 years ago. And because we have in the Mennonite church different arm, different ways. So we have some people here from this kind of faith like 7 years ago. But these colonies that arrived like 9, 8 years ago are different from these other people. And this one came from Mexico, and the origin of these communities are from they were from Europe, the center of Europe. They went to Canada at the beginning of the 20th century, and then they went to Mexico, and they went to Paraguay, they went to Bolivia, and like 8, 9 years ago, they are finally arrived to Colombia. This special way of the Mennonite faith, they believe a lot in the relationship between the community and the land. So most of them are farmers, but I think the investigation shows that more than farmers, they are like a huge agro-industrial companies, because of when you see the money, when you see the magnitude of the inversion and also of the produce, the money that they have, you can see that they are more like a company than a group of farmers.
Okay. And as Natalia said, they're based in the Llanos Orientales. And close to Puerto Gaitan. How did they get this land?
We don't know. We have just talked with them just once, and a colleague of mine, another journalist who interviewed them, she asked how they knew about Puerto Gaitan and about this region in Colombia. And they say that in 2013-2014, someone in the United States told them that here in Colombia we had a big region where they can came and have a big plantation, and that we have the facilities, and the region was close to Bogota. So they say that they came, but they didn't say who was the person that gave them this information.
Because I know when we talked about the history and them coming, you know, from Canada, because Canada actually expelled them at the beginning of the 20th century. I remember this story. And Colombia, you know, Bolivia, no civil conflict, Paraguay, very minor civil conflict if we're actually considering it. But Colombia, there's a very long-running, very well-known civil conflict. It's not doesn't seem like the obvious place for, you know, a Mennonite community to set up. And the Llanos Orientales have lived some of the worst issues of the conflict. So how does this you have to give me some more background on this. I mean, are they not at risk? Because there were the Mennonites in Tijuana recently, or near to the border with Mexico, who were a dreadful murder of a whole family. And I think they're leaving there because of this issue. So, I mean, it has to be similar for them here in Colombia, no?
Okay. Here we have a couple of issues about that. The first one is that after the peace process with paramilitary groups in 2006, this region has like a peace period that was used by the Colombian government to invite a lot of big companies, national and international big companies, to change the use of this land to create a massive field of or rice or corn cultives. I don't know if I am trying to explain.
Okay, it's fine.
So the Colombian government, especially between 2004, 2005, invite a lot of companies, for example, an American company, Cargill, that is Cargill, one of the biggest agricultural companies in the world. So in these years, during the next 10 years, a lot of people, a lot of big companies, national and international, came here and bought a lot of land, but huge, huge farms with land that was from the indigenous communities like 40 or 50 years ago. So in this place we have like a special piece created by the Colombian government to bring this kind of industries, and also petrol and gas companies there. So there was like a big movement of the Colombian government to create this space to bring companies. Okay, this is one. And the other thing is maybe sometimes these Mennonite colonies in Mexico and other sites in America Latina were victims of violence, also in Paraguay. But they also leave these places because they committed environmental crimes. And they leave the countries because they have a lot of problems with the justice and start to move to other countries. This is one important thing, that these colonies came to Latin America because our rule of law are so weak, if you compare, for example, with Canada or the United States. And they can use, for example, land, and they can they can change, for example, the environmental places without any strong position from the state, because most of these states see them like money, like big companies. They bring some money to these countries, so they don't see a problem in most of these cases. Where the Mennonite colonies go.
I understand. Natalia, as you have an environmental engineer background, perhaps we could talk about some of these environmental crimes.
Yeah. I read the study made by Rutas del Conflicto, and I found out that it's not only deforestation, one of the damages they are causing to the environment, but they are also building infrastructure that is not supposed to be in these lands. For example, they have built bridges made of concrete that do not really go well with the environment there. And they are doing all of this without the proper permission beforehand. They also are constructing wells to make use of the underground water, which is not something they are legally doing. So they are doing a lot of activities that are now being actually filed by Corpo Macarena. I understand that Corpo Macarena has actually filed some procedures in order to make them stop, but nothing has been really that strict or effective for them to stop doing all of this. Do you know what's been happening in the last few months? Has anything changed regarding the environmental authorities that are supposed to be taking care of these lands, which are actually one of the most biodiverse in the country?
Well, actually, last Monday or last Tuesday, I don't remember, we published a new update of our investigation. And we showed that, I don't know, I think it's at least seven Mennonites has investigation for the Fiscalía General de la Nación, the Colombian government. So they have they have cases in the Colombian justice for environmental cases, especially because they, I don't know how can I say in English, deforestation, maybe. I don't know if it's this word.
Deforestation.
Yes, deforestation. They deforestate a lot of, not a lot of, but some hectares in this land. I also think that these communities has a special view of the land, so they don't see a big value in a forest, in a small forest or something like this. They just see the land to produce food. So I think this is the big problem in these communities, because when they see only this in this way, they sometimes destroy part of the nature. And that's why they have these cases in the Colombian justice. And this view have a big problem with the view with the indigenous people who live close there. And these indigenous communities are just saying to the Colombian justice and Colombian government, we live there for hundreds and hundreds of years. We need this land back. And they have a very, very difficult conflict between these two communities, the indigenous communities of Colombia and these Mennonite colonies, because of this, because they are just have a legal fighting for this land. And they have a very different views about the use of this land.
So the Mennonites see it as plainly production. And do they sell to, I don't know, do we see that their whatever they produce, does it turn up in Corabastos? Does it turn up in Palo Quemado? What do they produce? Where does it go?
We need to think that they have between 38,000 and 84,000 hectares. So it's huge, the land. It's huge. We don't know exactly how much, because in our investigation, we checked 38,000, but they talk about 44,000. This land is huge. This is not about to produce a small amount of food to sell in Corabastos no. They have a huge production who sell to another big food companies close to them. For example, their neighbors are La Facenda, which is one of the biggest brand of pork in Colombia. So part of this food that they produce are sold to the La Facenda. Also, they sell rice to one of the biggest company of rice in Colombia, Flor Huila. So we see like a huge production of food. This is not like a, it's difficult to see them like a small farmer. No, we have also in this investigation, we invite all of the people that are listening this program, that if you can just go to Ruta del Conflicto and see our investigation. We also found a lot of records of amount of money that they bring to Colombia, and it's a lot of money. Also because they transform the land a lot, and that for that we need money, a lot of money. And also, for example, they put electricity in this area. They built a lot of some schools, all the infrastructure to live. So we are not talking about some farmers. We are talking about a community that works like a big company.
Exactly.
How many people in their community then?
Oof, I think like 120 families, like about 5,600 people.
So 5,600 people working and inhabiting an area of Colombia that's bigger than the Netherlands.
Yes,
it's amazing, isn't it? And when you've done this investigations, have you been down to the land and been down and seen their projects?
Yes, my colleague Pilar Puentes, she traveled there like 3 years ago with another colleague. Both of them, they were to the colony. They talk with them. They also they also were with the indigenous community that in this travel, this trip, they were with the community, indigenous community, when this community went like by force inside of the land. It was, we tried to show how this conflict has been just higher and higher and higher, and we have some cases of violence there. The some leaders of the indigenous communities have said that they have received threats. How can I say
threats?
Yeah. Threats. Mm-hmm. And also the violence there has been high and high during the last 2 or 3 years. But it's difficult to say who is the actor that are producing this violence. But every time we have more and more and more news about this place and news related to this conflict between the indigenous community and the Mennonite colonies.
I read that the police and the police forces of Colombia actually took them out of the territory to the Sicuani community, right? Which is the indigenous people who are demanding for this land. But I find it quite interesting that apparently the police there is taking care of the Sicuani communities living there, and they removed them by force, but they are, until now, so far, they have done nothing regarding the Mennonites communities. I don't know if this is because they have some kind of legal protection. What do you know about that? Why they are like so balanced towards one side and not the other? What's happening there?
Well, I have just 5 minutes, sorry. But this is very important because I think historically, the Colombian government, the Colombian state, have take advantage of the situation in favor, I can say, in favor of the Mennonites colonies, and in all the companies, and against the farmers or against the indigenous or Afro communities, not just in this place of Colombia, in several places of Colombia. We have showed in several investigations how economic powers in join with political powers to, I don't know how can I say in English, capturar or cooptar the Colombian government, the Colombian state. So it's very easy to see in this case, for example, the governor of El Meta, of the department of the state in Colombia, talking all the time in media about the Mennonites colony. Yeah, because they say they pay taxes, they bring progress, and they don't talk anything about the indigenous communities. So we have here the like a fight between two different models, and one of these models have been supported by the Colombian government, the Colombia state. We can see just in small events like, for example, what Natalia were talking about, the support of the police, for example, to push out the indigenous Sicuani from a piece of land. But also in the past, for example, this land were from the indigenous community for hundreds of years. And the Colombian government, they, how can I say, unknown? Like they say, no, they are not your territory. You don't have paper to show that it's your territory. So there was like a transformation. There was a legal, how can I say, despojo of these communities to support this huge business of agriculture in the last 20 years, agriculture, but also in the past, petrol there. And also you can see because all the Colombian army and the Colombian police have worked in this way, no, to protect all these inversions, all these, how can I say, inversions?
Investments. Everybody knows.
Okay.
Oscar, I know you have to run. I know you have to run. I just have one last question before you, and then Natalia and I will talk. But did this growth largely come under the Santos government after the 2016 peace accord, or is it something that occurred before?
The process all these companies start to arrive. I think the first company to get there was a petrol company in 2003, and he was and that it was brought by Álvaro Uribe Vélez. I think during the second period of Álvaro Uribe Vélez, they invited the government of the Álvaro Uribe Vélez invited a lot of companies like La Facenda, Cargill, Monica Semilla, the richest man of Colombia, Luis Carlos Sarmiento, also get there to buy huge pieces of land. But especially the case of the Mennonite colonies were from the first and second government of Juan Manuel Santos, 2014-2015.
Yeah, I figured as much. But Oscar, you have to go. I should send everyone to your website, rutasdelconflicto.com. Yeah, it's an excellent, excellent website for all of the news about the conflict here in Colombia that's not reported, obviously, in the mainstream media. And that's a little bit of what we try to do here in the Colombia Calling podcast. Oscar, thank you so much for your time. Hopefully we'll get to talk to you again, because I can see that there's a wealth of knowledge that we have yet to tap. So thank you for your time. Natalia and I will continue to discuss the Mennonites in Colombia and this sort of land dispossession. Adios, Oscar.
Okay, gracias.
Thanks. Thank you, Oscar. Thank you. And congratulations for the work you do. It's very necessary here in Colombia.
Thanks a lot. And thanks to help us to show our investigation. Okay. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
See ya.
Bye.
So unfortunately, our time with Oscar is up. He's a very, very busy man, but I cannot impress upon you enough the Rutas del Conflicto, rutasdelconflicto.com. Natalia, it's you and I chatting now. I have more questions, and I know you've done your research, so you can help me out on this. I have more questions. Now, this exploitation of the land from an environmental perspective, and you know, these areas of Meta and Guaviare, which is just straight south from Bogota, so that's where we put them into context. You mentioned as well that it's incredibly environmentally delicate and diverse. It's where the plains meet the Amazon. We have a government in power underneath Gustavo Petro that is a very environmentally minded government. This is one of their key pillars. Do you see any, as someone who knows so much about the environment here, do you see that the government might react to the, let's say, the negative presence of Mennonite communities here? Do you see that they might actually get involved? Susana Muhammad, who's the Minister for the Environment, what do you think about this?
Yeah, one might hope so. And I was actually really surprised that there are already several, I think it's like over 15 filed allegations against the damage that they're causing to the environment in these regions. But it's sad to know that so far, it's only been like the situation has just been left there. There is no much progress that at least until the last days we have seen. And it's something that happens very often in Colombia, that maybe there are some allegations and the environmental corporations of each region make some legal movement, but we don't see any fast progress that can really avoid these communities and many other different industries, the deforestation that is happening in the entire country. But with Mennonites, I think we have to take into account that what they're doing is not only the deforesting, but they are also changing the land use, which is something that over the years is going to have diverse impacts on the environment. And I think fauna and flora of the Meta department is going to be greatly affected by this. Unfortunately, there is not still a great research on the effects on the environment, because I guess it's really hard to get to this place, and field reporting probably is very, very difficult. But I think it's already important to know that there are media outlets like Ruta del Conflicto who are already doing their research and are constantly reporting on what's happening. So hopefully someone else listens to this podcast and pays more attention to the Mennonites, because I think it's completely overwhelming to know that they are doing all of these, that they, without any legal consequence, are occupying these lands that were acquired through very rare methods, and that they have really not had any repercussion on this. So hopefully in the future we can see more research on this, and we can find new ways to find solutions.
It's tough, isn't it? Because you have the first, as Oscar mentioned, you know, the governor of Meta, look at the production, look at the taxes, look at the, but this is short term, because the environment is long term. And we do have listeners who are very, very involved in environmental protection. And I've had the head of the Norwegian sort of environmental group here. He's been on the show, and people who are academics. But, you know, academic, unfortunately, reporting goes to academics and doesn't go always into the, doesn't go to, like, yeah, to say headlines in Caracol and or RCN. Well, of course they wouldn't, because, like Oscar mentioned, Luis Carlos Sarmiento, who owns most of those things, is one of the huge landowners. But like you said, it's a far off place that's difficult to get to, difficult to see what's happening. I believe similar sort of things, not with the Mennonites, but similar sort of things are happening in Valpes, Guainia, other far-off departments with no real communication. This is what the worry is, that one day we'll find out and it will be too late. I'm curious, though, about all of this, because I just, it's so hard. We knew that the government of Álvaro Uribe was promoting it, and we also knew that the government of Juan Manuel Santos was pushing it, and of course the Duque government as well has pushed things massively towards China and everything else, and this and another, and now we've got an environmental government. I think this government we have right now has a lot of good ideas when it comes to the environment, their ideas so far. And given the difficulties that they are having with scandals surrounding the president's son, blah, 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 you would think that he would focus on some environmental norms to score some quick wins, if you know what I mean, to get some political traction. As we wind this down, Natalia, I want to ask, what do you feel might be an outcome of these communities, the Mennonite community there in Meta? The indigenous people of the Sequani are not happy. The traditional communities, the Afro communities, are not happy. Do you think there's a possibility of even more violence?
Oh, definitely. Unfortunately, that's what's happened in other countries. And that's why they actually in 2014 made the decision to come to Colombia. According to what Mongabe and Ruta del Conflicto found out, in Mexico, they were already having a lot of trouble with farmers in Mexico. And they found that the conflict was already too hard to deal with, and they came to Colombia for that and for many other reasons. They found more water available for their production here too, because they had already exploited land in Mexico. And it's sad because I've seen that they are already in 5 countries in Latin America, and the damage they're doing doesn't seem to stop. And as Oscar said, we don't have strict regulations to avoid all of this damage to happen. And I think it's something that definitely the government needs to look more deeply into. But I have not seen Susana, the Minister of the Environment in Colombia, talked about this, at least not so far until now. And I don't know if it's because the Mennonites work in such a silent way that we are only discovering what's happening, which is a shame, really, because I fear that we'll see in 10 years' time the damage they have done and the loss of species that they probably will cause, they are already causing, and there's nothing else to do. And as you said, the agenda in Colombia is so busy with so many other issues that seem more important than the environment, even though this government regards so dearly, apparently, doesn't seem to be so important. The budget, for example, for the environment, the Ministry of Environment, is not as high as people expected. So, I mean, we hope that things definitely improve in the environmental aspect of Colombia, but by what I've seen, things are moving really slow, and there are many different environmental issues that need more attention and need more action and more faster action. But that doesn't seem to be happening because, for example, a very discussed matter these days, which is the I don't know how to say it in English actually, but there's lots of species in different regions of Colombia, and there are some measures to be taken according to the scientists of Colombia who have been researching on these matters for many years, and the Ministry of Environment seems to agree on this, but they are not really taking action. So everything moves really slow in Colombia. And I think that's the biggest issue. If we tackle that, we're probably going to get results in the 3 years that this government has left. But yeah, we need more action for sure.
It's tough when you say, you know, there's all these cases that are in the Fiscalía, but it's all tangled up in legal. Obviously, you know, the case has been brought against whomever, and we're not just identifying that. You know, the topic of this podcast is the Mennonites, but it's really a catch-all topic for what's going on in Meta, Guaviare, and places like that. Let's not even get started on palm oil, but it's a catch-all. It's not directed at them for any religious persecution or anything like this. It's just the environmental damage. But as you say, it all gets caught up in the Fiscalía, so in the courts, and then of course they submit, you know, they reject it, and it comes back and it comes back and it comes back, and before we know it, we're in the next government. And so therefore, and then they have the Ley de, I can't remember, when they archive the cases after a certain amount of time. I can't remember.
I don't know.
They just get put away, and then that's it. And that's it. And so this is the legal issues. And it's very hard. It's very hard to see how this can be, even dealt with if it's not getting the coverage that it needs. And I don't know. I mean, Natalia, you are a journalist, you are a documentary maker, you're an environmental engineer. I think you need to get down there with your camera and get down there with an academic or two and film some stuff and do some interviews. Of course, don't take any risks that might get you in trouble, but I think we need, you know, it needs to be seen. It needs to be seen. Yeah. I don't know, I understand. So tell me, Natalia, what is your next project? What are you going to be working on next? Because we know that you studied at the University of Sussex. You've studied all of the right things. You said, this year I'm working on journalism. Journalism is my passion. What can we see you in next? Or where can we see your writing next?
Well, I have been researching on a very important problem in my homeland, in my home city, which is Sogamoso. Mm-hmm. There is a very important lake that is very well known in Colombia, which is La Laguna de Tota.
Tota, sí.
Which is heavily polluted. And this is an issue that has been happening for years, but no one really has paid a lot of attention to. And there's already research made in the academia, precisely, by some great biologists, but these investigations have not really come out to the public. So my idea is to keep on digging what's really happening in La Laguna de Tota, because there are so many issues around this matter that really need more attention, and find out why the laguna is so polluted, which are the causes of this, and try and help my community somehow, because my own family is being affected by this. Mm-hmm. 2 years ago, there were allegations that the laguna was polluted with heavy metals. Mm-hmm. And this is an investigation that has not really had any result yet. Like, we don't know the current state of the laguna. We don't know if heavy metals are really present there or not, because there were some laboratory studies made there by CARC Cundinamarca, the Regional Environmental Corporation of Cundinamarca. And I saw how they took samples of the water of the laguna, but the results of this never really made it to the public. We don't know what they found out there. So I'm trying to find out what's happening there. And whenever I do have an answer, I will publish it for sure. Mm-hmm. And I will do it through a new project that I'm doing, which is Green Libachue. I'm trying to communicate science in social media, because now it's a great outlet to use, to make use of. And in my channel, in Green Libachue, I'll try to communicate diverse environmental matters that are relevant in Colombia and in the world.
Okay,
yeah.
So Green Leaf Bachue.
Greenly?
Greenly.
Bachue. Bachue, which is a goddess, very important in Colombian history.
I would expect, and Laguna de Tota is phenomenal. It's so beautiful. Yeah. And then there's that area that the white sand beach. So if you catch it on a good day, and it could look like the Caribbean with the blue and the white sand.
Yeah,
it's really I went
cold.
On a bad day and it was so cold. It was so cold.
Oh, it's extremely cold for sure.
But I would imagine there's also a lot of pollution from pesticides from the farming communities around there as well. And then, of course, there's coal nearby as well, isn't there? So there has to be some heavy metals coming in through from these places. So
yes.
I hadn't thought about it. I think it's probably a very, very important information. So is your Greenly Bachue, is it on YouTube? Or where can we see it?
Yeah, it's mainly in Instagram. It's an Instagram account for now, but I do also have a YouTube account where I publish like the largest documentaries that I make. Well, I do mini documentaries, you know, because nowadays audiences don't like long
they don't listen
stories to pay attention to. Yeah,
We know that here on the podcast too. So yeah. Anyway, but yeah,
go it's on. Nice to know that your audience really listens for a longer period of time. That doesn't happen anymore.
No, we're one of the few, I think. But anyway, it's very nice. Listen, so Natalia, I should say thank you so much for getting Oscar, doing the hard work and the research. It was really special to listen to Oscar Parra, and I'm sure we'll get him on again because he's got too much to talk about. Natalia Malaver, it's been really fun, and we've had communication for more than 2 years. Now we finally meet, albeit virtually. but now I know what you're doing, the Greenly Bachway. I'll put it up on our social media and so on. And thank you. Thank you for everything. Thank you for your time and thank you for your enthusiasm in the podcast. And anyone out there listening who needs a documentary maker, who needs a go-getter journalist, you know, you can find her. It's not hard to find her on social media. We've got to help one another out. So Natalia, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Richard, for your generosity. Thank you so much for this space. And it was great listening to you and to Oscar and learning from both of you.
That's fine. Flattery will obviously get you everywhere. And as I say to everyone in journalism, and you know, especially when starting out, question everything. Don't take no for an answer. So this has been episode 485. Can you believe it? Or is it 458? I can't remember. I don't remember. It's so long. But thank you, everyone, for this. And it has been incredible listening to both Natalia Malaver and Oscar Parra. We'll be back next week with more interesting interviews here about Colombia. What did you think of last week's with Emily? Described as the ineffable Emily by one of our listeners. Emily's talking to Maria F. Fitzgerald about her book. I actually got to meet Maria at an event here in Bogota. What an amazing person, amazing journalist. Prior to that, we had Ricardo Cuides from CODES talking about human rights and displacement in the Canal del Dique area. So we're always trying to, you know, mix it up a bit and tell the stories that aren't being told here in Colombia. If you want to support us, you can check out www.patreon.com/Colombia Calling. You'll find that link all over our social media as well. Thank you again to everyone. And please subscribe and stay listening. So that's been me and Natalia for this week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The Colombia Calling podcast is sponsored by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. We are also sponsored by BNB Colombia Tours, which is a leading tour operator providing a wonderful range of exclusive small group shared tours for those over 50, along with customizable private tours to both popular and off-the-map destinations throughout this beautiful and diverse country. If you're interested in experiencing one of their unforgettable journeys through Colombia, be it a shared tour with like-minded travelers or creating a unique private package of your own, just complete the form on the Colombia Calling website, that's www.colombiacalling.co, or the BNB Colombia Tours website, that's www.bnbcolombia.com, and they'll be in touch within 24 hours to answer all of your questions and to start the planning of your exclusive Colombian adventure. So that's bnbcolombia.com and Latin News.com. Thank you for supporting our sponsors.